Well, we have made it to the seventh and final gift. We've been looking at the motivational gifts of the Holy Spirit, those gifts listed in Romans 8. We added another reading in because the literatures are feeling like the same thing again. But I'm guessing you all know that verse from Romans well now, those few verses from Romans listing those seven motivational gifts of the Holy Spirit. We've stressed each week that we have each been blessed with a unique blend of those gifts. We have those gifts to benefit others and to fulfill God's purposes. We've considered the positive and the negative of each of those gifts. We've talked about how that can come with some problems, how it can also govern our worldview, how it governs the things we love and the things that make us really angry. We've looked at all those characteristics, drawing from a book written by Don and Katie Fortune. And we have considered how each gift might impact our passions, our perspectives on the world, and our relationships. We've done that with the gifts of perceiving or prophecy, serving or ministering, teaching, exhortation, giving and administration or leadership, and finally, we come to the gift of compassion, the gift that 30% of the population have as their dominant gift. And as I told you when we started this series, that should tell us all something about just how important compassion and loving kindness are to God. As with giving and serving, we are all called to show compassion to others. We are all called to be loving and merciful. We have biblical mandates for that. I'd be hard-pressed to tell you otherwise. We are told to be merciful as God is merciful. We are told that the most important gifts are based on loving God and loving others. When Jesus gave his disciples a new commandment on his very last night with them, that commandment was that they were to love others just as he loved them. So the biblical mandate is there, and we are all called to be loving and compassionate. But some people are specifically gifted in the area of compassion. And those characteristics show us that, from Don and Katie Fortune. Those with compassion as their dominant motivational gift have a tremendous capacity to show love. And they always look and focus on the good of others. They're not just interested in the real and current good. They're also focused on the potential good for that person. They can see potential where others may see only trouble. Those with compassion as their dominant spiritual gift are wired to sense the spiritual and the emotional atmosphere of both groups and individuals. And they have built-in radar that easily detects insincerity and wrong or ulterior motives. They are attracted to people who are hurting or in distress. They are just naturally drawn to those who happen to be withdrawn or excluded. They are naturally drawn to those who are lonely or friendless. That is true even in their childhood years. That child with the gift of compassion is the one who's going to notice that everyone else is kind of shunning or excluding a child, that child is sitting off with them set by themselves, that they have no friends, and they're going to go over and be that child's friend, even if the other children in the class wind up being upset with them because they've gone off to be friendly with this child who is maybe different or maybe new to the community and doesn't fit in and maybe doesn't have the courage to go and make friends themselves. The compassion person will notice and seek them out and comfort them and befriend them. Those with the gift of compassion will go out of their way to relieve the distress of others. They rejoice when others are blessed, and they grieve when others are hurting. They crusade for good causes, and they intercede in prayer for those who are hurting. But all of that leads to some problems for the person with the gift of compassion. They tend to empathize too much with the suffering of others. They are prone to go on the offensive for others and to try to fight those battles for them. And they are easily hurt themselves. Those with the gift of compassion are generally more concerned with mental and emotional distress than they are with physical distress. They grieve over broken relationships, and they are natural peacemakers. And as a result of that, they are highly motivated to facilitate healthy relationships. Those with the gift of compassion choose both their words and their actions with great care. They don't want to say something or do something that might hurt someone. So they're very careful about what they say and what they do. And as a result, they hate to be rushed in any job or in any activity. They are also perpetually late. So if you have a family member with that gift of compassion, you might want to tell them that whatever event they're supposed to join you for is maybe 15 or 20 minutes early. If they happen to have both the gift of compassion and the gift of exhortation, you might want to double or triple that little white lie that you are telling. They love to do thoughtful things for others. They love opportunities to give preference and place to others. They are the ones who will say, "Oh, you look exhausted. Go ahead of me in line." They are the ones who might even let you go ahead of them in the doctor's office if you look like you're really sick or stressed out or just can't stand to wait any longer. They love to give preference and place to others. And that may be another reason why they are perpetually late. They go out of their way to avoid conflicts. So they often have trouble making decisions, another one of the problems for them. You may know them if you're trying to decide where you're going to go to eat for lunch or dinner, and they're like, "Well, you decide." "Well, I decided the last time. Where do you want to go?" "Whatever you want is just fine." They will roll with the punches. They want to make everyone happy. My mom had this gift. She would never decide where she wanted to go to eat. She struggled to make decisions, and she was kind of a chameleon. She just fit in with whoever she needed to fit in. She always gave preference to the other person. Those with the gift of compassion are trusting and trustworthy. They are typically cheerful and joyful, and they are ruled by their heart rather than their heads. Biblical examples of those with the gift of compassion include the Good Samaritan from Jesus' parable by that name. And they also include a Moabite widow and daughter-in-law named Ruth and a Jewish man named Boaz. That story of the Good Samaritan is a story that I know you are all very familiar with. It actually begins as a lawyer, a teacher of the law, stands up to test Jesus. And he says, "Teacher, rabbi, there are hundreds of laws written, hundreds of rules in the laws of Moses, hundreds of rules in the Torah. So which one of those rules is the most important?" And Jesus says, "Well, you're a student of the law. How do you read it? What do you say? What do you see written there?" And he says, "Well, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul. That's the first. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself." And Jesus says, "Well, you've answered well. Go and live that way." And wanting to justify himself, the lawyer says to Jesus, "Well, just who is my neighbor? Who is it that I have to love as much as I love myself?" And I'm sure he is looking for a very narrow answer. What's the other students and teachers of the law like you? Or it's the people who live near you? Or maybe it is all the people within the covenant community, all of the Hebrew people of the nation of Israel? He wants to justify himself, and he's looking for a narrow legalistic answer. And instead, Jesus tells one of his many parables. And Jesus says, there was a man who went down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and as he was traveling down that road, he fell upon some thieves, and they beat him up, and they robbed him, and they left him on the side of the road for dead. Just so happened that there was a priest coming down that same road. He was coming down the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, which most likely means he'd completed his priestly duties for his assigned time, and he was on his way home. Sure, he was in a hurry to get home and be with his family. So he sees the man. He doesn't want to get involved, doesn't want to put himself at risk. He passes by on the other side. A Levite, on his way from Jerusalem to Jericho, coming down the same road, probably same situation, finished his duties in Jerusalem in the temple. He too's probably on his way home. He sees the man, same thing, passes by on the other side. Ah, but a Samaritan on his way down that road, he has a different response. Now, he has not been working in the temple. He has not been to the temple to worship. Samaritans did not believe in worshiping in the temple. They only had the first five books of the Bible. They knew nothing about a temple. They were used to worshiping on the mountain where their ancestors had worshiped. And so he's most likely going up and down this road, traveling for some sort of trade or business. He's well known to the innkeeper, apparently, known as a man who is trustworthy. But he comes by. I'm sure he's as busy as the others, maybe more so, got a much further distance to go. But he sees that man on the side of the road, and he has compassion for that man. He puts himself at risk. He goes over, he bandages up the man's wounds, puts him on his own animal, takes him to an inn, spends the entire night taking care of him. And in the morning, when he's absolutely got to get on the road again, when he has business to take care of, he takes money out, gives it to the innkeeper, and says, "Take care of him for me. And if you spend any more than that, I'll pay you when I come back this way again. You know me, and you know I'm good for it." And Jesus then says, "Okay, which of these three men acted like a neighbor to that man who was robbed and beaten and left for dead?" And the lawyer has no choice but to say, "The Samaritan, the person who I would not consider a neighbor, the person who I consider an enemy, that's the one who showed compassion." Jesus says, "Go and do likewise." That's Jesus's parables for you. They sneak in, and then all of a sudden it's like, I got to make some changes here. But we see that gift of compassion at work in the Samaritan, the least likely person who we would expect to see it in, at least the least likely person that a Jew would have expected to see that gift at work in. The other story about compassion is one that very rarely makes it to the lectionary, a story that you may not even know. It's a beautiful love story worthy of a Hallmark movie. It's got one of those wonderful endings to it, but you would not know it when it starts off. It seems that there was a woman named Naomi. She was from the town of Bethlehem. There was a famine in the land. There was a drought. And in order to feed their family, Naomi and her husband and their two grown sons traveled to the land of Moab. While they were there, those two sons each married Moabite women. And then Naomi's husband passed away. And then both of her sons passed away as well. So Naomi and her two daughter-in-laws were left to fend for themselves as widows. And they were left in that predicament in a world that was not always kind to widows. In a world where when you did not have a man to fend for you, to provide for you, to speak for you, you were often in deep, deep trouble. Well, Naomi herself, having a lot of love and compassion for her daughter-in-laws, suggests to both of them that they might want to return to their father's house. They are still young enough that hopefully their father could find a new husband for them and they would once again be properly cared for. Neither one wants to leave Naomi. This is a loving family. These two Moabite women have learned about the loving kindness of God from Naomi, from their husbands, from their father-in-law. Initially, they both refuse to leave Naomi. Finally, one does agree, and she returns to her father's home. But Ruth says, "No way. I am not going to leave you under any circumstances. Wherever you go, I will go. And your God will be my God, and your people will be my people." And so Ruth and Naomi make the journey back to Bethlehem together. They return to Bethlehem because Naomi has property in Bethlehem. I'm sure it is in ill repair. I'm sure the fields had not been planted during that time frame. But at least Naomi feels like she has relatives in Bethlehem. Maybe something will work out. Well, as soon as they arrive, Ruth realizes that Naomi is too elderly to care for herself. And with great compassion, knowing the laws of the people of Israel, at least some of the customs and some of the laws of Moses, she goes out to glean in a nearby field. She goes out to do what she can to provide not only for herself, but also for the mother-in-law whom she loves and whom she is devoted to. She knows that the rules in the land of Israel are, when harvest time comes, you do not fully harvest everything on your land. You leave stuff on the edges and on the corners of your fields for the poor to come and to glean so that they too can eat. So she goes out to the field. By a God incidence, I'm sure not a coincidence, she winds up in the field of a man named Boaz, a man who also has great compassion. He notices she is there gleaning, collecting the grain that she can from the edges of the field and from the corners of the field. He inquires about her. He learns that she is Naomi's Moabite daughter-in-law. He is impressed by the fact that she stayed with her mother-in-law. He is impressed by her willingness to go and glean to provide for her mother-in-law. And he gives instructions. He goes to Ruth, and he says, "You are to eat with the women from my household so that you are safe and protected. Help yourself to water whenever you need it." He then goes to the men who are handling his harvesting, and he says, "When you are collecting the grain, I want you to do more than just leave extra grain on the edges and on the corners. I want you to accidentally drop some of the grain as you are going along. I want you to make the gleaning easy for Ruth." What amazing compassion. So she follows behind and she collects all of this grain, far more than an ordinary gleaner would have collected on that day. She goes home taking it all to her mother-in-law, who is just astounded at what she's managed to glean from the fields. She inquires as to where she's been. She learns that she has done her gleaning in the field of Boaz, who has said, "Stay here, don't go anywhere else," who's offered to protect her. And she says, "He's a relative of ours, and he is a good, compassionate man. Do as he says." She also instructs Ruth in the customs of her people. She lets Ruth know how she can let Boaz know that she is available and that she would like him to be her kinsman redeemer. And Ruth obediently goes through the customs and through the process. And sure enough, Boaz says, "What do you want me to do for you?" And she says, "I need you to be my kinsman redeemer. I need you to redeem the property that belongs to my mother-in-law and her late husband, Naomi, property that would have belonged to my late husband as well." And he goes and he checks things out. He realizes that there is one other person with the first right of refusal. There's a closer relative. He talks to that man, who is initially like, "Oh boy, I could have that property." But then that man learns, "Well, you'll have to marry Ruth. I don't want to mess up the inheritance for my kids. I think I'll pass." Well, that is what Boaz is hoping for. And Boaz says, "I will marry Ruth. I will become the kinsman redeemer for Ruth and for Naomi." And in great compassion, these two work things out together. They are married. And Ruth is blessed with a baby son. So Naomi has a grandson that she never thought she would have, that she can love in her old age. And it turns out, here's the Hallmark happy ending for sure, but with a cliffhanger, the baby that Ruth and Boaz have, that beloved grandson of Naomi, is named Obed. And Obed is the father of Jesse. And Jesse is the father of King David. And that puts Ruth and Boaz in the messianic line. That puts Ruth, who is an immigrant and a foreigner, in the messianic line. That's God for you. And that is the power and the value of those with the gift of compassion. God works through them in amazing and powerful ways. So there we have it, the gift of compassion. It is the final motivational gift of the spiritual gifts identified in Romans 12. And that brings us to the end of our series. But where do we go from here? Well, maybe you have identified with enough of the characteristics of one or more of these gifts that you've said, "That's me. I know my dominant gift. I even think I know some of my secondary gifts." And maybe you have a strong sense of exactly how God might be calling you to use those gifts in combination with life experiences and with natural talents as well. Or maybe you know your gifts, but you're wondering how best to use them. And maybe we need to talk and to dream and to pray together. Some of you may be thinking, "Well, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, if I'd have known then, I might have done these things, but not now. I'm aging, my health is a problem, I just don't have the energy I used to have. What am I supposed to do with this?" Well, I'm here to tell you that God does not waste anything. There's actually a song called "Here for a Reason." It's written by Ashes Remain. And in that song they sing, "Every day that your heart keeps beating, there's purpose for your life. So perhaps what you are called to do at this point is to identify others with the same gifts that you have and encourage them and act as a sounding board for them and share some experiences with them and certainly pray for them and maybe even fund some of what they are called to do. Every day that your heart keeps beating, there is purpose for your life. Don't forget that. God doesn't waste anything. Maybe you've identified your gifts and you're beginning to see how your gifts interact with the gifts of others. You're beginning to say, that's why I get frustrated with that person. That's why I get upset in these types of situations. That's why I feel the way I do. I know as I've gone through back through some of this again and remembered what I learned some years ago, I've been reminded of that, and it's like, that's why that situation upsets me. That's why that person sometimes rubs me the wrong way. It's been very helpful for me as a pastor. So what I'm going to invite you to do, if you're comfortable doing it in your own time frame, we put a survey form, just one page in the bulletin. Fill out whatever part you'd like. Maybe you're feeling like, I still have no idea what my gifts are. Maybe you'd like us to order you a copy of the book and go through that. Maybe you'd like to do it with a group of other people who you've shared in ministry with. Sometimes others see things in us that we do not see in ourselves. But whatever you're comfortable doing with that form, please use it. Tell us what you think your gifts are. Tell us if you want a book. Tell us if you want to talk. It is there to help you. Using our God-given and Spirit-breathed gifts is part of our baptismal covenant. 1 Peter 4 was most likely a baptismal letter. And those words say to us, like good stewards, good caretakers of the manifold grace of God, serve one another with whatever gift each of you received. Whoever speaks must do so as one speaking the very words of God. That relates to the gifts of perceiving and teaching and exhortation and administration. And whoever serves must do so with the strength that God supplies. That relates to the gifts of serving and giving and compassion. And our, as we close this out, the final hymn that we have, our hymn of response, is to a familiar tune. You'll find the words in your bulletin. There are many ways of sharing. It is to the tune of Come Thou Fount of Many Blessings.